The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the colon is presented by Dr. Jack Bragg.
Disease of the colon largely includes inflammatory bowel disease, probably the most common thing. So let's look at ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. This slide is important from a couple of different standpoints. Number one, mucosal ulceration in the colon is what is going on with ulcerative colitis, as opposed to on Crohn's disease, there on the right side of the screen, transmural inflammation. And what that means is transmural inflammation goes all the way through that part of the GI tract. With ulcerative colitis, it's confined strictly to the mucosa. That's important, especially when we start talking about complications, because the complications you see in Crohn's disease are secondary to the fact that there's transmural inflammation, and you don't see those complications in ulcerative colitis because it's mucosal only. IBD epidemiology, this is largely a disease of late teens and early 20s. I live in a university town. Majority of IBD patients are high school or college students or that age group anyway, but notice that you can see it from one end of the spectrum to the other. About 5-6 years ago, I had a call one Sunday afternoon from one of the pastors of the church I attend. He said, "Jack, my 19-month-old is pooping blood. What should I do?" So I got him set up with a pediatric gastroenterologist, and it turns out that he has ulcerative colitis at 19 months. So you can see it on that end of the spectrum, and you can also see it on the other end of the spectrum. Smoking exacerbates Crohn's disease and protects against ulcerative colitis. Why that is, I don't think anybody has any idea, but you do see it clinically. And what it means is we all try to get our patients to stop smoking for a variety of reasons, but Crohn's disease is another reason that they should stop, because they're harder to treat when they smoke, the medicines don't work as well, they go to surgery more often, they get second surgeries more often. It just makes life miserable for everybody if they won't stop. But we don't start anybody on smoking to protect against ulcerative colitis. It's just a clinical finding. Distinguishing features of the two diseases overlap to some degree, but you can see there on the slide, bleeding and tenesmus are more common in UC, and perianal disease, fistulas, abdominal pain, much more common in Crohn's disease than UC. These are a comparison of the anatomy of the disease process, what they look like endoscopically, the gross pathology, and the biopsy. Biopsies are not helpful oftentimes. If there are granulomas, then that usually means you're dealing with Crohn's disease, but only about 30% of all Crohn's patients have granulomas, so it's something that you're going to see a lot of the times. There is a category called indeterminate colitis, where we know the patient has inflammatory bowel disease, but we aren't sure which one. And to some degree, it's not critical to know which one it is, because treatment is similar and you're going to treat them with basically the same drugs anyway. Diagnosis. What do you see endoscopically when you have a patient with ulcerative colitis? You see a loss of vascular markings, diffuse erythema, exudate, and hemorrhage. On the left there is mild, and then moderate, and then severe. The other thing that's different about UC from Crohn's is that UC starts here and it stops there. There's a well-defined, unless it involves the whole colon, there's a well-defined area that ulcerative colitis covers, and you can tell where it starts and where it stops. It may just involve the rectum, it may involve the rectum and the sigmoid, it may go all the way up to the splenic flexure. Crohn's disease, on the other hand, you have skip lesions. You have some normal tissue, some disease, normal tissue, disease. It's much more erratic than ulcerative colitis is. Rectal bleeding, mucus in the stools, tenesmus, diarrhea, and abdominal cramps are typical clinical features for ulcerative colitis. For Crohn's disease, chronic abdominal pain, diarrhea, perineal disease, distension, weight loss, fever, rectal bleeding occasionally, and in kids, growth failure. Now, what this means is that the average time between the onset of symptoms and diagnosis in an ulcerative colitis patient is about a week. And that's because rectal bleeding gets everybody's attention and they get scoped pretty fast. Crohn's patient, on the other hand, the average time between the onset of symptoms and diagnosis is 6 months. And that's because about half the patients you see in the office have chronic abdominal pain anyway. A lot of them have diarrhea if they have IBS diarrhea predominant. Now, if they have any of these other things like perianal disease, perineal disease, fevers, weight loss, growth failure in a kid, that's going to spark an investigation quicker than chronic abdominal pain and diarrhea will. Some other clinical features you'll see in Crohn's disease from time to time: bowel obstruction, it may present with that. It may present, especially in youngsters, with what everybody thinks is appendicitis until the surgeon opens them up and finds an inflammatory mass in the right lower quadrant, and lo and behold, the patient's got Crohn's disease rather than appendicitis. Fistulas, which can occur just nearly any place that diseased gut touches, you can develop a fistula. Abscesses, again, because the disease is transmural, you'll have pelvic abscesses, psoas abscesses, just nearly any place where there's diseased gut. Gallstones, kidney stones, and steatorrhea, all common in Crohn's disease. Toxic megacolon is where you have a degree of inflammation that is so great that it basically shuts the whole colon down and it's paralyzed. And when that happens, there's no peristalsis, there's very little absorption, but there continues to be excretion, and you end up with this kind of a picture. And notice what you've got here. This is the transverse colon right here, this sigmoid-shaped object. Notice how thick the walls are. Transverse colon, thickened walls. This is a patient with such severe inflammation that the colon has stopped working and it's starting to expand. This becomes a surgical emergency. Patient has to go to the OR. Now, it's much more common in an ulcerative colitis, but you can see it in Crohn's colitis as well. Extraintestinal manifestations. These are kind of fun from the standpoint that it's something different. It's something you don't see all the time. Roughly 10% of all patients with inflammatory bowel disease will have one or more of these extraintestinal manifestations. Again, these make wonderful board questions, and I'll show you a few examples. Skin, joints, eyes, liver, thromboembolic phenomenon. There's also pulmonary and renal complications that we hardly ever see. These, especially the joint problems, are the ones that are the most common. Now, you might be shown a picture like this one on the left and given a history of bloody diarrhea over the last week to 10 days, fever, weight loss. What's your diagnosis? Well, in this case, it's going to be ulcerative colitis. Erythema nodosum is not specific for inflammatory bowel disease or ulcerative colitis specifically. You can see it in other illnesses, but if you see it in combination with the GI symptoms, you're very likely dealing with ulcerative colitis. Pyoderma gangrenosum there on the right, again, is not specific for inflammatory bowel disease. And what you're looking at there is the anterior aspect of someone's leg, but you can see it other places. I've seen it on the arms. I've seen it next to a stoma. Seen it various other places besides on the anterior aspect of the lower extremities. Colorectal cancer is a risk factor for a patient who has ulcerative colitis in greater than one-third of their colon. And it's a fairly aggressive and tough type of colon cancer to get because it arises from flat mucosa rather than adenomas. Infiltrates broadly, it's uniformly distributed, it's anaplastic, and it tends to occur. The incidence goes up once your ulcerative colitis patient has had their diagnosis for 8 to 10 years. And so when you get to the 8 to 10 year mark, the recommendation currently is colonoscopy with biopsies every 10 centimeters throughout the colon. That you may, in that fashion, pick up on an early cancer or a dysplasia. It's not a great way to surveil people, but right now it's the best we have. Chromoendoscopy is probably going to become the standard of care for doing that down the road. The arthritis aspect of it, this is a tough problem to deal with. It tends to be monoarticular, it's asymmetrical. Large joints versus small, no synovial destruction, no subcutaneous nodules, and it's seronegative. The physical exam is normal. Their joints are as normal as yours or mine. Well, mine aren't normal, but as yours, they probably look just like that. There's no swelling, there's no redness. The joint's normal, and you think, well, how bad can this be? But I've seen enough patients that have bad joint pain to know that it's significant pain that sometimes doesn't even respond to narcotics. I usually try to get pain management, pain clinic involved when it's like that, because they can manage the big drugs better than I can. But severe pain is the primary manifestation. Now, when you control the inflammatory bowel disease, you may control some of these extraintestinal side effects, but you may not. But that's always step one when you see one of these, is to try and get a handle on the ulcerative colitis or the Crohn's, whichever one that you're dealing with. And hopefully, whether it's joint problems or skin, they will come under control as well. Indications for surgery. Who goes to the OR? A lot fewer people are going to the OR for ulcerative colitis today than they did 20 years ago, primarily because of the advent of biologics. But here are some indications: exsanguinating hemorrhage, toxicity, and or perforation like the megacolon I showed you a minute ago, suspected cancer, significant dysplasia, either high grade or low grade, growth retardation in kids, systemic complications like unresolvable joint disease or some of the other extraintestinal things I showed you, systemic complications and intractability. They had no longer respond to any of the medicines. Those individuals are candidates for a total proctocolectomy. Complications in Crohn's disease. What you see here, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are fistula connections between two parts of the gut. I've seen it between the ileum and the sigmoid. I've seen it between two parts of the small bowel. Enterovesicle between diseased gut and a ureter or a bladder. Retroperitoneal, a connection between diseased gut and the retroperitoneum. Or enterocutaneous, a fistula between diseased gut and the abdominal wall. You can see it between diseased gut and the vagina. You can see it virtually any place diseased gut touches. You can get a fistula from it. Endoscopic appearance of Crohn's. I'm not sure why I didn't have this earlier, but better late than never. It looks like aphthous ulcers sometimes, or you can see stellate type of ulcers, longitudinal ulcers. You may see pseudopolyps, which look like run-of-the-mill polyps, but they're basically just from inflammatory conditions in the gut. On the left-hand side down there, you see these are the aphthous ulcers here, the little white areas. Right there. Stellate ulcer, the second one, longitudinal ulcers, and at last, pseudopolyps. You can kind of tell from pictures 1 and 3 there, the normal intervening mucosa between the disease in Crohn's disease that you don't see in ulcerative colitis. If you are shown one of these x-rays and the history is of chronic abdominal pain, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, weight loss, fevers over the past 2 to 3 months, and someone obtained a small bowel x-ray, what's the diagnosis? Well, what you're looking at here, this is colon here, cecum. This is the terminal ileum, and the terminal ileum over here. It's almost obstructed here. Colon, cecum here, and this is the terminal ileum, and again here. It's called a string sign, and it's significant for Crohn's disease. I don't know, there may be one or two other things that may cause a string sign, occasionally something like tuberculosis of the gut, or possibly sarcoid, but 99% of the time when you see this x-ray, it's going to be Crohn's disease. Breakdown by ethnic and racial classifications, Jewish people are a lot more prone to get inflammatory bowel disease. These are reflections of genes, genetics. Caucasians fall somewhere in between Jewish people and African American or black people. They have it less than anybody else in these categories that you see right here. And again, this is all probably secondary to genes. This is largely, inflammatory bowel disease is largely a disease of Northern European descent. Not exclusively, because you'll see occasionally Asian patients, Asian Americans, or other ethnic groups that have inflammatory bowel disease, but it's unusual in them compared to these three groups that you see here. Management includes medicine, obviously. These are the drug categories that we use. I don't have time to go into them individually. Let me say that with ulcerative colitis, drug of choice for initial treatment is mesalamine. There's several different varieties of mesalamine. For Crohn's disease, it's budesonide. Budesonide is a synthetic steroid. Does the same thing as prednisone as far as healing goes, but you have much fewer side effects. And these others have some use. I'll talk about when we use some of these others as well. If you have a patient with proctitis, in other words, just disease of the rectum, mesalamine suppositories are the drug of choice. If they have disease in the rectum and the sigmoid, or further up the colon, then mesalamine enemas plus oral mesalamine is the way to treat. Steroid enemas are available. They don't work as well as the mesalamine enemas. You can use them if that's what you like, but mesalamine works better. Sulfasalazine is an old drug that, I think I've got a picture. Yeah, this is a picture of it. It's an old drug. It was first discovered by the rheumatologists. It's a reasonable treatment for joint disorders. Rheumatologists noticed that their patients who had rectal bleeding and joint disease, the rectal bleeding got better when they started them on sulfasalazine. And then the gastroenterologist picked it up and started, it was the first drug available for the treatment of ulcerative colitis. Now, the reason I show it to you is because what somebody did then was to split this azo bond in the lab, do away with this, which causes most of the side effects of this drug, and connect the 5' ASA molecule with a carrier, and that's where we get aprezo and some of the other currently available mesalamine products that we treat ulcerative colitis with. More drugs, basically those same list. You'll see budesonide on this one. You didn't see it on the other, although there now is a budesonide treatment for the colon. This is for the small bowel. That's where it's most active, but with a different additive or a different framework, I don't know what to call it. They marketed budesonide now for treatment of disease of the colon as well as disease of the small bowel. But you use a lot of times these drugs in combination. Anytime you put somebody on prednisone, you're thinking, okay, now how can I get them off? Prednisone at best is a short-term solution. However, we do have patients that we cannot get off prednisone. They're in remission, they're doing well, but they're on 20 milligrams of prednisone and they're starting to have side effects, moon facies, hair loss, acne, weight gain, fluid and water retention, and they hate that. So you want to get them off prednisone. Usually what you'll go to next is either a biologic if they're very ill or azathioprine 6-mercaptopurine. Start them on one of these immunomodulators. Give it some time. It takes a while for AZA or 6-MP to work, but oftentimes then you can wean them off the prednisone and just keep them on the immunomodulator, the azathioprine. You can use it if you have a patient with ulcerative colitis who has one or two breakthroughs a year but does well most of the time. Azathioprine or 6-MP may prevent those breakthroughs and keep them in remission. Azathioprine and 6-MP work somewhat in fistulizing disease. They can prevent post-op recurrence. Prevention of colectomy for ulcerative colitis after cyclosporin, but there's much better drugs than azathioprine for those indications. Tumor necrosis factor is a big player in the inflammatory process. You can see here the the role that it plays. There's a soluble as well as a membrane type of tumor necrosis alpha. It kicks in the nuclear factor blocker here, and that's what causes the inflammatory process to continue to advance. The advent of the biologics block the tumor necrosis factor and take it out of the equation. Infliximab was the first one. There's now a biosimilar, similar to infliximab, but it's not infliximab. I don't have enough experience with it yet to tell you whether it works or not, but infliximab is a IgG1 molecule. It binds both varieties of TNF, soluble and transmembrane. The ACCENT-1 study was one of the pioneer studies that was done to show that infliximab does reduce the inflammation in the colon of a patient with active Crohn's disease. There are now about 6 biologics on the market. Some of them work by controlling or blocking alpha tumor necrosis. A couple of them work by blocking egress of white cells out of the vascular system into the tissues. Diarrhea, Dr. Kirshen covered most of this. I think I'm going to skip over some of this because she did a good job going over those and get to lower GI bleeding. Massive hematochezia, what do you do? Well, usually what we do is purge them with a PEG solution and try to do a colonoscopy as soon as possible. If that's not possible, then usually an angiogram, find out where the bleeding is. Most of the time with most lower GI bleeds, we don't see active bleeding when we go in. We may see a diverticulum with a clot in it. We may see angiodysplasia. We may see a tumor. Any of those things can be responsible for causing lower GI bleeding. But most of the time, by the time we get a scope in there, the bleeding has already stopped. Not always, but most of the time. If it doesn't, then if you have an interventional radiologist, again, they can treat angiographically, or otherwise patient goes to the OR. Here's the most common etiologies: diverticulosis, far and away the most common, and usually right-sided diverticulosis. Unknown again, and malignancy, probably the closest behind diverticular disease. These are some of your therapeutic and diagnostic options. Colonoscopy is the quickest and the best way to find out what's going on as far as diagnosis goes. These other things are available in specific circumstances. Therapeutically, you can clip, you can treat with APC, argon plasma coagulation, heat, various different things depending on what the source of the bleed is, and I'll show you a few of them here. Initially, we resuscitate, lots of IV fluids. If they don't have renal failure or CHF, you can almost not give too many fluids. Upper endoscopy, if it's a very rapid bleed and you're suspicious that this may be a duodenal ulcer that's bleeding very, very quickly. Oral purge, I mentioned a while ago, urgent colonoscopy. Find out where the problem is and what it is, and you can take care of it endoscopically, or the IR person can. This is an active duodenal bleed, diverticular bleed. We don't see that very often. It's unusual to see a diverticulum actually losing blood, but you will every once in a while, and that's good because that gives you the diagnosis. Otherwise, if you just see diverticulosis, you're not quite sure. This is an arteriogram, and right here is extravasation of contrast. And this patient has a vascular abnormality right about in the hepatic flexure or a little bit further towards the cecum. What causes diverticular disease? Well, it's probably the low fiber American diet that causes an increased amount of pressure in the sigmoid colon. That's where the majority of them are. That causes I think it's called the vasovasorum, I can't remember for sure, where the vessel comes through the colon wall into the mucosa of the colon. That causes a diverticulum like you see there on the far right, and occasionally that vessel will bleed. This is an AVM right there, arteriovenous malformation. If we think that's the cause of the bleed, we'll treat it with argon plasma coagulation, very effective treatment. This is a elderly gentleman who had radiation therapy for prostate cancer, and what you're seeing there is radiation proctitis. And in this case, he has bled from this area right here. Again, we can treat that with APC or heater probe therapy if you so desire. This is a liver spleen scan. I don't know if anybody does liver spleen scans anymore or not, but this is a positive one that's in here because it's positive. Up here you have the liver and the spleen, and here you have, again, this is probably hepatic flexure or right colon where the contrast is gathering. And they have to be actively bleeding before this is going to be a useful test. If they bled this morning and they're not now, it's probably not going to be helpful. Microscopic colitis. Two varieties of microscopic colitis, collagenous and lymphocytic. Now, they both present the same way. They both present with chronic watery diarrhea. Endoscopically, everything looks normal. Usually females, 50 to 70 years of age or older. The biopsy is where you make the diagnosis. And this is probably the most common failure I see in the non-gastroenterologist who does endoscopy. They oftentimes see a normal mucosa, so they don't do any biopsies. But for these particular entities, you have to biopsy because the pathologist will see either a thickened collagen band in the patient with collagenous colitis or a super lot of lymphocytes in the patient with lymphocytic colitis. Now, there's a few drugs, Tegretol being one of them, that may cause lymphocytic colitis. Collagenous colitis, we don't know what the cause of it is. You see it oftentimes in diabetics, but not necessarily. Treatment, there's a list of potential treatments about that long, and whenever that's the case, whenever you have a list of treatments that long, that usually means that nothing works very well. And that's the case with this. Bismuth does work. Budesonide probably works as good as anything. I've seen people respond to mesalamine. I've seen them respond to steroids, 5' ASA, any number of things. Methotrexate. I've seen them respond to a lot of different things. And it may be a matter of trying this and then that and then the other before you find something that works. Pneumatosis coli, otherwise known as pneumatosis cystoides intestinalis, is a rare disorder of the GI tract. You have multiple gas-filled cysts in the submucosa of the gut. You distinguish it from pneumatosis linearis, which is strictly a mucosal abnormality. Most cases occur in the small bowel, but about 6% in the colon, usually on the left side. And you see there are some associated conditions that may show up with this. Here's what it looks like on barium enema. It's fairly obvious. I don't know how many radiologists still do barium enemas. They don't at my institution. But you could probably see this on endoscopy or a CT scan. Now, the next disorder are these mucin-filled cysts here that you see on an endoscopic picture of this colon. And this disease is colitis cystica profunda. Again, unusual. I don't know that I've ever seen a case of it, but it's in the literature. Three different patterns that I won't take time to go into. The etiology is unknown, but it may be associated with diseases that predispose to ulceration, like IBD, infection, cancer, those types of things. Presents with bleeding, mucus, diarrhea, or prolapsed rectum. And endoscopically, it may look like cancer, polyps, or lipoma, or it may look like the slide that I just showed you. The endometriosis. Everybody thinks endometriosis is strictly a disease confined to the uterus. You can have endometrial involvement in the sigmoid colon, and what you usually see is a necrotic-looking mass. Can involve the appendix or the ileum as well. Oftentimes it's asymptomatic, but you can have lower GI bleeding with it, and it can cause pain. The differential, you can see there at the bottom, IBD, diverticulitis, tuberculosis, ischemia, neoplasia, all have to be ruled out and usually can be with the appropriate biopsies. I think this is probably the last slide, SRUS, solitary rectal ulcer syndrome. It's a disorder of evacuation, causes rectal ulceration, erythema or mass associated with straining, rectal prolapse, found on the anterior wall of the rectum. Symptoms include constipation, mucus, blood. Diagnosis is by histology. You biopsy it, make sure it's not cancer. Treatment is improved bowel habits, treat the constipation, whatever's going on. Biofeedback has shown some effect as well. Okay, that's it.